and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 10th, 2021. So here in the state of Massachusetts, we have a new legislative session has just begun, and surprisingly, I think there are a lot of bills about climate change. There is one major one we've spoken about many times called the Next Generation Climate Bill, which goes back and forth between the governor and the legislature, being vetoed and resubmitted and all kinds of stuff. But there are other bills out there as well. In the effort to address climate change, one of the very important things is to have a copious supply of clean energy. And one of the bills that's in front of the Massachusetts legislature is to do exactly that. It's a bill that has somewhat cumbersome name called, an act transitioning Massachusetts to clean electricity, heating, and transportation. But its nickname is the 100% clean, the 100% clean act, which basically wants to get Massachusetts to set up the policies to get Massachusetts as a state to have both clean electricity to power our lights and do all the usual stuff, and to have clean energy to have our automobiles and our homes be heated without making carbon dioxide emissions. So tonight, we are fortunate to have with us an expert, in fact, someone who's had a big hand in actually writing the 100% Clean Act, Mr. Ben Hellestein, the State Director for Environment Massachusetts. Welcome, Ben. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So Ben, I just went through a little introduction of the 100% Clean Act. Did I get it right? Or how would you explain the circumstances for what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think you described it accurately. The key points of the bill are that it would transition Massachusetts to 100% clean electricity by 2035. And 100% clean energy for heating and transportation by 2045. So it targets the three largest sources of fossil fuel use and carbon emissions in Massachusetts, and puts us on a path to completely clean up those sectors over the next couple decades.
Tell me, what are those three sectors, just for people who may not be that close to it?
Yeah, so it's 100% clean electricity by 2035, and 100% clean heating and transportation by 2045.
Okay, super.
Yeah. So you know, this bill, it's about setting big goals and ambitious targets, but it's also about putting the policies and requirements in place to make sure that we achieve those objectives. So across all three of those sectors, it includes a number of measures to make sure that we actually reach 100% clean energy. While also making sure that workers in environmental justice communities are included in the transition.
I mean, that's a very interesting point, because I know the original 2008 Global Warming Solutions Act was considered to be aspirational for a long time, right? This is something we wanted to do. We're going to be noble and try and do it. The 100% Clean Act has sort of enforceable mechanisms in it, right? I mean, that has teeth.
Yeah, that's right. And that's absolutely our intention. And I think that, one of the shortcomings in the Next Generation Roadmap bill that you mentioned earlier, we do support that bill. And we think that there's a number of very important pieces that are in there to move us forward. But we also think that just the act of sort of setting emissions targets and expecting the state to come up with a plan to meet them is not necessarily going to be sufficient to actually get us where we need to go. And, we've seen, for example, with the governor's climate plan, the draft climate plan for 2030 that came out a few weeks ago, there's a number of really good pieces in there. Like, for example, committing to phase out the sale of gas-powered cars by the year 2035, but it really falls short in a number of other ways. And I think that really the only way to make sure that we get where we need to go in terms of transitioning away from fossil fuels to clean energy is for the legislature to be very clear in its intent and to pass the policies necessary to make that a reality. And so I'd say, this bill is really, it's about learning from experience, both with the Global Warming Solutions Act and with the climate bill that passed last session and with the governor's climate plan, taking some of the best pieces that have come forward And then building on that and making sure that we're, you know, across all three of these major sectors, we're accelerating our progress.
So tell me, if we focus for a bit on the clean electricity, so that I think that's a term of, I would say, term of art. That's a specific kind of a defined thing in the bill. Right? So clean electricity, tell me what that means and explain in more detail what the, you know, how we're going to get there and when and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the bill defines clean electricity as electricity that basically is produced without the emission of greenhouse gases. And the types of clean energy that we are most focused on are renewable energy, which you could consider to be sort of a subset of clean energy. And, you know, those are the resources like rooftop solar or offshore wind. There's a few other things that kind of fit in that category, but really mostly we're talking about solar and wind. Mm-hmm. And what this bill would do is it would require 100% clean electricity by 2035. So utilities would have to provide all of their electricity without carbon emissions. And at least 80% of that electricity would have to come from renewable sources like solar and wind that are located within New England. And the way that the bill proposes to make that happen is by building on a really successful program called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, or RPS. So this is a policy that has helped get Massachusetts to, now we're at, I believe it's 18% of our electricity from renewables like solar and wind, and we would increase that requirement gradually over time to get to 80% by 2035.
And that, just, dear listener, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, RPS, that's a big one. That's what, that should register in your head, right? Because we will keep coming back to the RPS. The RPS standard, basically the RPS is a requirement on the utilities to use clean energy. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ben. And the way they demonstrate that is by buying these what are called credits, and we'll just class one credits, renewable energy credits, which represent, I think this is a really good thing, they represent wind and solar installations here in the New England area. Right. Mm-hmm. So they're not buying wind turbine credits from Texas or something. They're making, we're doing it here. Isn't that the idea that the utilities have to buy these credits, and therefore the utilities will demand that these local renewable energy things be built?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the way that I think of the electric grid, right? So, you know, in Massachusetts, we're part of the New England electric grid. And so we're, you know, basically a unit together with the other five New England states. It's sort of like the electric grid is a big bathtub, right? So, you know, every time a generator of electricity, whether that's a solar panel or a wind turbine or a gas plant or a nuclear plant or whatever, every time they're producing electricity, it's like they're dumping a cup of water into the bathtub. And then, you know, those of us that are using electricity in our homes, you know, we're taking out, you know, maybe a, you know, teaspoon or a tablespoon, right? But it's like, you know, you don't necessarily know when you take your tablespoon of water out of the bathtub exactly where that water came from, right? Because it's all in the tub together. And so the way that the utilities demonstrate that they've met the requirements of the Renewable Portfolio Standard is they buy renewable energy credits, or RECs, that are produced by the renewable energy facilities. So when a solar panel or when a wind turbine generates a unit of electricity that they provide to the grid, they also generate a credit. And then the utilities buy these credits to show that they have purchased a certain amount of renewable electricity. And that's really important because actually the value of the credit itself is like an incentive or a subsidy that's given to the solar and the wind facilities. And so that helps to make renewable energy more appealing to the people that want to build it, and ultimately helps to lead to more of that being developed across the region. So, you know, bottom line is that by increasing the RPS in this bill, you know, we're going to see more solar panels going up on our roofs. We're going to see more wind turbines spinning off of our shores, and ultimately, you know, getting closer and closer to a future where actually 100% of our electricity is coming from these renewable sources.
Right. I think that the genius of the bill is to take advantage of this existing mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. So the RPS is all laid out. All these things are defined, the class one credits, this, you know, all this kind of stuff. And this bill says, yeah, we know how to do this up to the 18% you've said. Now we're going to increase our ambition and say we're going to do this even more each year. And that's a marvelous way, I think, to get to the total amount of clean electricity we need. Mm-hmm. So tell me, the what's the capacity? I mean, I have heard stories that say, as we go forward to the year 2035, as more and more electric vehicles run around the streets, we're not just going to need to replace the existing power plants with wind turbines. We're going to need even more electricity because everything is going to be electrified. All the stuff that used to come from burning, you know, your car, for example, now has to be electric. Is there enough electricity out there in the New England area, renewable energy, to support the growth that you see from now to the year 2035?
Well, we'll have to build a lot more. You know, we'll have to build a lot more solar, a lot more wind, to be sure. But there's no doubt that we have the potential to make these goals a reality. And we released a report a couple of years ago called Wind Power Despair, which looked at the potential for offshore wind energy in Massachusetts and other states up and down the coast. And what we found is that Massachusetts actually has the highest potential for offshore wind power of any state in the country, including states on the West Coast.
Really?
Yeah. And our potential is equivalent to 19 times the amount of electricity that's currently consumed in the state each year. And even when we convert all of our heating and all of our transportation to electric power, which, as you noted, is a really important step to eliminate fossil fuel use, even when we do that, we'll still have enough offshore wind potential to provide more than 8 times as much electricity as the state is going to need. And so that's offshore wind alone, right? So we're not even talking about, solar power. We're not even, not even necessarily talking about all the energy efficiency improvements that could be made to reduce our use of electricity. So there's no doubt that the potential exists. And really, what we need is the policies and the requirements in place to drive the development of more solar and more offshore wind.
I mean, I think it's a fascinating point that Massachusetts has such of New England area has such an opportunity. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's because the wind, we have both the wind and a relatively shallow ocean just off the shore, right? It's only a couple hundred feet. So it's not like I think out in California, it drops off to very deep water rather quickly. So we right. have this, and as you say, all we have to do is get our act together to take advantage of it. When you say, so here's a kind of a technical question, but when you say there's enough wind potential, that means that we have mapped out tracts of the ocean, areas of the ocean offshore that are large enough to support a certain number of wind turbines. And then that when you do that arithmetic, you end up with much more power than we actually can, 8 times the power we think we might need to consume, right?
So there are areas of the ocean off the coast of Massachusetts and other states that have already been designated as wind energy areas. And some of them have actually been auctioned off and sort of developers have purchased the rights to be able to put up wind turbines in those areas. And so the first offshore wind project in Massachusetts, Vineyard Wind, which we actually just had some really good news about that earlier this week.
And what's the good news? Say the good news.
So the good news is, so the project has been, Ted, I mean, it's been like a decades long odyssey to bring offshore wind power to Massachusetts. And, Vineyard Wind is slated to be the first project. It was very close to getting its final approval. And then the Trump administration essentially pulled back on it and threw up some additional roadblocks. And the developers basically decided to press pause because, my sense is they didn't want to leave it up to the Trump administration necessarily to decide what was going to happen. And then the good news that happened just earlier this week is that the Biden administration has restarted the process on Vineyard Wind and announced that the project is going to get its final approval likely in the next few weeks. So it's very exciting, and so we're going to see turbines spinning off our coasts in the next couple years finally after a lot of hard work.
I mean, just not to go too far down the rabbit hole of wind turbines, but I think they're pretty interesting. I've seen this reports of something called a Haliade wind turbine, this enormous, I mean, these 15 megawatt, these huge things, that they're only going to get bigger, right? It's a good, so you were saying there are tracks off the coast that are all laid out
yes.
in order
yeah.
to,
yeah, so there's already, the plan, yeah, already right? some areas that have been identified for wind energy development. The figure for the overall wind potential takes into account other areas beyond that. So areas that have not yet been sort of, leased for wind development. But it does exclude protected areas of the ocean that have been established as, you know, sanctuaries for various types of wildlife, and also areas that would be, you know, unsuitable either because they're too close to the coastline or they're too far out or whatever it is. So anyway, so we don't expect that we actually would build 8 times as much as we need, because we don't need that much. But just to give you a sense of sort of what, you know, what's possible.
Well, I think the bill points out some other fascinating things about the generation of electricity. So one of the things I noticed, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the bill calls for, I think it's 15% of the clean electricity to come from distributed solar panels that are in neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. That, and all I can think of is, you know, Texas 2 weeks ago, right? I mean, no distributed. I mean, what's the point? Tell me about the distributed power requirement in the bill.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us have seen, you know, even just in the last few years, it seems like solar panels are popping up everywhere, right? So, you know, I remember growing up, you know, this is not too long ago, you know, that it would be rare to see solar panels on the roof of somebody's house, you know, and now if you walk around, at least in certain neighborhoods, it's almost commonplace. And, you know, we see them, you know, along the sides of our highways and, you know, over our parking lots and, you know, on the roofs of, you know, grocery stores and school buildings, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of interest in going solar and in having this renewable energy resource, you know, in our communities. I think there's a lot of benefits to it. You know, it creates opportunities for more resilience, as you said. So, you know, particularly if we pair rooftop solar with energy storage, you know, critical facilities, you know, whether it's a, you know, fire station or police dispatch center or whatever, you know, can continue to operate, you know, even during natural disasters. It can also cut down on the need to invest in grid infrastructure. So if we're producing energy closer to places where it's used, we may need less transmission, which can be quite expensive to build. And, you know, I think it also creates the opportunity to have more stakeholders in the transition, right? So, you know, everybody who has solar panels on their home or on their school or the place where they work, you know, they all become part of this clean energy transition, and they become, you know, almost advocates in their own right. And I think that's just really important, you know, just that we have, you know, that we're building a movement, you know, as we sort of look ahead to all the challenges that we're facing. So I think, you know, for all those reasons and more, I think it's really important that this bill, as you said, sets aside, you know, at least 15% of the new renewable energy that's being built is going to be in our communities, which, you know, would be mostly rooftop solar, but also could include things like, you know, for example, small wind turbines, you know, in places where that's an option.
Super. So, tell me, this bill is now, there's the old joke about making sausages making laws and sausages, right? This bill is now somewhere in the sausage machine on Beacon Hill being turned into a law. What can people do? How can people support this, this bill as it goes through? What should people do?
I think the most important thing is for people to contact their legislators and ask them to support the bill. It was just introduced maybe three or 4 weeks ago, so it's still very new. And there's a long road ahead of us to turn the bill into a law. So as your listeners may know, in Massachusetts, we have 2-year legislative cycles. And so a lot of bills that were introduced in, you know, January or February of this year won't actually see a final outcome until July of next year, which is, you know, it's a long time. So it's really important to be keeping up momentum and continuing to build support and advocate for these policies consistently over that period of time. And our focus right now is on recruiting as many legislators as possible to sign on as co-sponsors for the bill. So that's a really crucial way to show support. And you know, if you have kind of a critical mass of representatives and senators behind you, it helps to get the bill taken more seriously.
Ask that if you call or write to your representative or senator that you want to ask for, please co-sponsor the 100% Clean Act, which is something that the representative does. He puts his or her name to the bill, right? And then you can, okay, good.
Right. Yeah, no, it's very, it's very explicit. You know, you can hold them accountable, you know, for if they did it or they didn't. You know, I think a lot of aspects of the legislative process often are kind of mysterious to people. You know, it's not always clear exactly what is happening at any given point, but this is an opportunity where every legislator can go on the record of, you know, supporting or not supporting this bill. And so you want to ask them to co-sponsor the 100% Clean Act, and you want to give them the bill number. So for the House version, so for representatives you're calling, it's House Docket 3551, and for senators, it's Senate Docket 2205.
And just to if people want to go to the Environment Massachusetts site, that information is on a fact sheet there. What's the website? Tell me the website again.
Yeah, so it's www.environmentmassachusetts.org. And if you look at it, it's under the issues that we work on, renewable energy, and then there's a page for our 100% renewable energy campaign.
Super, super, super. Well, what we'll do is we'll put up the links to that website and the fact sheet and everything so that people can get to it. And I, as I say, I think it's a good thing. Simple, call up and ask your rep to co-sponsor the bill. Well, those links will be on the blog. It'll be on the MCAN website at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have any questions about the podcast or any ideas or things we ought to talk about, please send a note to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we're doing right and wrong, particularly what we're doing wrong, because that's how we learn. You can listen to this podcast on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, etc., all the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends to listen to it on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. So because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Ben, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ted. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.